Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Somewhere Over the Rainbow is kind of a theme of narcissism, you know. It's this wish somewhere inside us that we're going to get to love by doing one thing or another. But it's going to come to us, you know, somewhere over the rainbow. And we keep hoping and we keep figuring that if we do the right thing, say the right thing, be the right thing, that we're going to get that feeling of feeling loved. Well, as you've heard in the previous CDs, there's two ways of going about it. You either become depressed or you become grandiose. If you're grandiose, well, you believe that if you do it, if you perform right, people are going to love you. If you're depressed, you believe nothing you could do can get people to love you. Both are illusions. Once you learn about the illusion, the grand illusion that's out there, that it's all about the past, you can bust it, you know. And that's what we're looking to do. So here, I'm going to play, I'm going to start playing tape, CD4, tape 4, and I'll get back to you, friends. Instead of living a life for the sake of an image or for the sake of other people. And this is a follow-up and the final in the series on narcissism, which we started a few weeks ago. In the last 3 weeks, we covered the issue of narcissism, what it means. And just for a review, I'll remind you that narcissism is our attachment to an image of ourselves. It's believing that we are the roles that we play. It's feeling an unconscious drive to succeed at something that may not even be what we like. It's like somebody else is driving the car, not us. Narcissism is the enslavement to somebody else's idea of who we should be, what we should want, and how we should feel. Very relative to what's going on in the world today. And this narcissism starts in childhood with our true selves, where our true selves is subjugated in exchange for the love and approval of our parents, and then our teachers, and then other folks along the line. So according to this perception, I, in my 25 years of professional practice as a psychotherapist and my 55 years of practice as a professional human, agree. According to this, the only way of living, of getting out of the living for love loop is to reclaim the self. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Now, this is very difficult because most people can't even remember what their true selves feel like. But you get hints sometimes when you're on vacation. Mostly the real hint comes at magic moments when you're alone and you feel filled with an inner sense of peace and well-being that's not the result of recognition, love, and approval from some outside source. Sometimes we get that basic felt sense of being okay regardless of whether or not somebody loves us, but that's rare. So we need a roadmap for finding out who we are. And there is, unfortunately, no map that works for everybody, regardless of what the psychotherapists, the gurus, the nutritionists, and the clergy tell you. But since I've been around for a while and tried and prescribed a bunch of find-yourself solutions, I'd like to offer you some of what I've learned. And let's start with the biggest belief in psychology and spirituality. To find yourself, you must trust your feelings. Right? No, that's a problem. Because what's a feeling? That's a whole major discussion in itself. When should you trust a feeling when all of your feelings are now based on a narcissistic image self, your unreal self? Your unreal self is the one that's doing the feeling. Do you trust your anger when somebody cracks your narcissistic image of your lovable self by not responding to you? You know, that's a feeling, anger. Do you trust depression, which is another feeling, when it's chronic? Or do you trust falling in love when you've fallen in love over and over again only to realize that reality did not live up to your fantasy? Feelings are very confusing. I did a show a while back on when to trust your feeling. It's a good education. If you want a copy of that show, you can call my office and we'll get you a copy. So here's another clue. There's no such feeling as rejection, for example. when someone doesn't respond the way we want them to, that's not rejection. Rejection is too big a word. Only our image self, which is basically the child in us looking for its parents' love and approval in some symbolic way, it's that image self that gets rejected. We just get turned down. If you're sensitive to rejection, then that means you're living the life of a child waiting for approval. And that's not a bad thing. It's just a tragic thing, because you're not running your own show. And you really have my sympathy, because I've lived that way myself. Now, here's another clue. Abandonment. You know, another big feeling, another big word. And not one that ever really takes place. It's another way of blaming someone else for our not being able to be alone. Oh, don't hit me with the occasional true husband abandons his wife and child incident, you know, the one that gets into court. He didn't abandon them, he left them. But people like that word so they could blame someone for their bad feelings when they really, what that question is, why are you so afraid to be alone? And we're going to get to that today. So as you can see, although the primary path to identify who you really are by being able to identify what you truly feel, well, it's very hard because how do you know what you feel when it's not you that's feeling it? It's this image self that's here that's doing the feeling. A lot of people feel angry because they're afraid of being hurt. They really feel anger, but underneath that feeling is hurt. Then there are a lot of people who feel hurt because they're afraid of getting angry. They feel hurt, but down deep inside, they're really angry. Does this begin to sound like psychobabble, a catch-22 that goes nowhere? Well, it's not. It's just a lot more than could be covered on a radio broadcast because everybody is different and no rule applies to everybody. It's hard work figuring yourself out. It's a lifelong task, I think. So let's look at what we can know for sure. And here's one way to look at it. Number one, the only way to see is to stop beating yourself up. You must allow yourself to observe yourself without criticism. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Now, if you were to make up a list of all your own worst characteristics and title it, My Worst Characteristics. Now, I'm going to be taking your call shortly because I'm going to ask you to do this with me. Make up a list. If you happen to be near a pen and pencil, write down My Worst Characteristics. Write that on top. It's important. And complete the list. Under that, absolutely write down everything you could think of. Write down at least five. Five of the worst things about yourself. And if you've got a moment, do it now. Your worst characteristics, those character traits that you don't like. Try to do it fast, and try to do at least five. Remember, write My Worst Characteristics at the top of the list. And under that, five things that you don't like about yourself. While you're doing it, I will remind you that this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind every Wednesday at 1 p.m. trying to give you some fresh ideas to learning about yourself. For the last 4 weeks, we've been focusing on attention, our attention on narcissism or the ideal image self of who we are. And today we're focusing on some of the ways you can reclaim your real self. If you've missed the series and would like a copy of today's program or of the last three, you can call my office at 757-4488 in New York. Now, to prove a point about narcissism, think about your list, right? You've got that list in front of you. It says on the top, My Worst Characteristics. It's got a number of things written down right next to the list, right next to each one of these things. Which of your parents would agree that these are truly bad characteristics? Which of your parents? Use an M for the word mother. Use an F for father. And put an M or an F or both next to each characteristic. And here's the secret. Whoever name appears the most in your, is the person whose love you're living for. Whatever name, the M or the F, if it's your mom and she just appears on all these characteristics that you hate about yourself, the ones that she would agree are miserable characteristics, that's the person you're living for. If it's an F, that's the person you're living for. We're going to get to the phones in a minute because I'm going to ask you to be a part of this. You get that? You're critical of yourself because you're not going to get their approval. It's their value system you're living by. If you wound up with physical characteristics, it's the same thing. Your appearance was important to your parents. They talked about appearance and looks. That's why you've gotten to your worst characteristics list. Now watch this one just for a trick. Cross out the heading, my worst characteristics and change the heading to my idiosyncrasies instead of my worst characteristics. Now you cross it out and you change the title. So on your list you have as my idiosyncrasies, I'm too sloppy, I'm too sensitive, I'm not organized. Now think about it. Does it change if you take it away from self-criticism and you make it evaluative? How does it change when it becomes my idiosyncrasies? And let's take a look at some of your lists. Let me get a few brave souls on the air right now to explore this by going over the list. If you've made a list, you can make one fast. Call me, 212-279-3400. I'm going to take a few calls, and we're going to look at a few lists because that's going to be part of our program. 212-279-3400. Let's take one of your callers who made a list. Hi there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hello, Mr. DeMille. How do you do?
Good. Call me Armand.
Armand.
Hi there.
Hi. My idiosyncrasies?
Yes. What are your idiosyncrasies?
We'll say dishonesty.
Uh-huh.
Sloppiness.
Uh-huh.
Chemical dependency.
Mm-hmm.
Dependence on others. Lack of money / self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of discipline.
Okay, now, who is the person that you could get next to each one of those?
Well, I have my mother there.
Yeah, on each one, right?
Well, my father has been, you know, he is deceased. When he was around, I don't know, he might have been on more of them. But I'm sure it's my mother that I was looking for, that's for sure.
See, so you get the idea, you know? These things, you feel bad about yourself being this way. You tend to be dishonest, you tend to be sloppy. You tend to be a number of things. Now, let's take this and get it off your self-criticism, right, or your mom's criticism of you. Now look at these and say, okay, here are my idiosyncrasies. These are the things I do, and make it okay to be this way.
Really?
Yeah, make it okay. Let's hear how you would do it.
Make it okay to be dishonest?
Yeah, make it okay to be dishonest.
Oh, you're saving somebody's feelings.
Well, that's one way of saying it. You know, I'm dishonest because I don't want to hurt other people's feelings. That's one way.
Uh-huh.
I'm a kind of guy who is so reluctant to hurt someone's feelings that I tend to be dishonest.
Yeah, but then you know what happens.
No, I know what happens. I know what happens. You know,
the truth comes out, and then everybody's more hurt than they would have been.
And you don't even like telling the lie in the first place.
No, you don't.
You'd like to live an honest life, but for the time being, you're too afraid to live an honest life. So you're a guy who lives a dishonest. You know, he says dishonest things. You know, now, I know in this world, for some strange reason or other, people think that a lie is the worst thing that a person could do, but a lie simply means that a person doesn't feel safe in telling you the truth. People lie to you when they don't feel safe telling you the truth. Do you have any people with whom you're never dishonest?
I have one person.
Yeah. Okay, a man or a woman? A friend?
It's a man.
Okay, and he's a friend, right?
Very good one.
A very good friend. Now, there's the difference. How come you're never dishonest with him?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he means too much to me, and I think he can handle it. He can handle the truth.
So, you feel safe with him. You feel safe that he's not going to break up, crack up, or beat you up because of what you tell him.
Right.
Right? So, there's kind of the proof, you know. You're not a dishonest person. But you become dishonest with people that you don't feel safe with.
Yeah.
That's one. And it's just a fact about your life. It's not the worst thing in the world. It's a thing you'd like to change it. Take a look at another thing. You're sloppy.
Right.
Right? Sloppy. You like things, you know, things are all around you. You'd love to have the house all cleaned up like your mother would love. But it's not. And you live that way, right?
Not anymore.
You gave up being sloppy?
Well, I moved in with somebody who won't take it, so therefore I can't be sloppy anymore.
Well, that's one way of getting it done. So thank you for showing us in a demonstration that, you know, if you look at it, and you look at it with a lighter heart, and you give consideration, who are you living for anyway?
But then we get down to chemical dependency.
Uh-huh. What about it?
Well, it'd be great if I weren't smoking.
Uh-huh. Sure it would be. But let's talk about what everybody does to adjust their chemistry in life. Yes, it would be great if you weren't smoking because of what it does to you and what it does to the people around you. But think about the chemical adjustments that everybody else does to their system, you know, including through nutrition, including through everybody's adjusting their chemistry all the time, and you're trying to find a way to adjust your chemistry better. And you happen to be listening to this station because probably you listen to Gary Null too, right?
Oh, sure.
And you listen to what Gary has to say, and you let a little of that impress you in your life, don't you?
Definitely.
Right? So you cut out your red meats?
Yeah.
Right? Right? So you did some things to adjust the chemistry to see how it feels.
Uh-huh.
and this is just another one yet to go. Just take off the badness. If you stop putting yourself down, you stop living in service of your parents. You know, you become your own person. We'll be talking more about that later in the program. Let me get to somebody else.
Thank you.
Sure. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You got a list?
Hi. My name is Andrea.
Hi, Andrea.
My idiosyncrasies, I guess inconsistent, selfish, I don't pay attention, angry at myself, and I lose drive.
Okay.
So.
And you don't pay attention, right? Now, did you get this when you were a kid? Do you remember somebody yelling at you and saying, you're selfish?
Oh, yeah.
Which parent?
Mother,
right? So his mom convinced you that you're selfish, and you're saying that about yourself. You're selfish. Does this mean, what does it mean to you to be selfish? What does it mean?
Taking care of myself.
And that's selfish, right?
Yeah.
But you consider it a bad thing.
Well, my mother was, there was something always wrong with her, and she was always taking care of herself, and she always came first. Mm. So, I guess consequently that's probably why I feel the way that I do. And I also have, I have a daughter who I battle with that. You know, I try to make her come first.
Mm-hmm. Oh. It's real difficult.
But, yeah, I still feel like I'm selfish if I'm taking care of myself.
So I guess if you look at it and you say, well, here's my one of my idiosyncrasies, I try to take care of myself. You know, when I take care of myself, sometimes I need to be able to take care of myself before I could take care of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if you take the judgment off that for a little bit and just make it a quirk about you, you know, just like your inconsistency, you've got an active mind. Your mind moves in a lot of places at once. You know, if you were going to be like everybody else, you would be very consistent. You would stick to one thing at a time, but you're not. Are you an artist?
Yeah.
I thought so. What kind of an artist?
Just lots of different things, you know, horticulture, you know, some type of crafts, or, you know, I mean, I dabble in everything.
Mm-hmm. And you really like to get into things, don't you?
Yeah, and what I have found in the past is that I jump in with 2 feet as opposed to kind of putting in 1 foot.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like a runner who would start off with all of her energy and then, you know, fade out about a mile down the road.
So you're a sprint runner, right? Now, we need sprint runners in life. You know, and the sprint runners don't become long-distance runners, but that's all right because sprint runners are important, too. You know, and kind of what I'm saying is one of the tools here for getting to know about yourself is to take the judgment off. And to take the judgment off means you take your mom and you put your mom a little aside so that you're living for yourself. These are items, all these items that you've said about yourself, you've got to just take them and let them be there. Let them be. Stop making war with them. That's the beginning of our task. We're going to be getting back to this. Okay?
We're
going to take another caller. Hi there, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air. What's your list?
Procrastination.
Yeah.
Paranoia / jumping to conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Overeating.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of focus and lack of discipline and being unforgiving.
And who are the who's the person that would be the most judgmental of you in these areas?
I have to tell you honestly, for most of them, it's both.
Both mom and pop.
Yeah.
Oh, what a terrible! What a terribly unsafe world you must have been in when you were a kid. Wow.
A mixed bag.
A mixed bag of nice and not nice?
Yeah, the patina was physical affection and words that denoted love and support, but the deeds and the behavior sometimes belied that.
You know, it makes you so punchy that you have to become vigilant as a kid. And that vigilance, if it is not the right kind of genuine love that comes with it, turns into this kind of paranoia and jumping at conclusions. Because as a kid, you had to figure out what they were really feeling.
Absolutely.
And that regular, trying to figure out what people are really feeling, you know, is what people call paranoia. You know, because sometimes you're trying to figure it out, so you imagine what they're saying, and you imagine what they're doing. I feel sorry that happened to you as a kid.
It's not, when I say paranoia, it's used in the colloquial sense, and it's an interesting, what's more accurate is jumping to conclusions. Sometimes it seems that a lot of people live at a level where they want you to read between the lines instead of being direct and upfront and honest, and you know, you were saying some people just don't feel safe to be honest, and that's an interesting way of looking at it, but... Mm. But then what happens is you interpolate, and what I find is I often interpolate to the extreme. Whereas
sure.
if it had just come out and been honest, it would have been much less severe.
Yeah, but you also are sharp as a tack.
Yes.
What do you do with your time? What's your profession?
I'm a performer.
You're a performer too, huh? And what kind of performer are you?
I'm a singer and a songwriter.
So you must be very creative too. You must, you know, have you written any, have you written songs?
Oh, yeah.
You've written songs. See, it's the kind of mind that goes out there. When you have this acuity for perspicacity, you know, when you can really get out there and really see things that other people can't see, then you could write other people's things that other people don't write in song. You can be differently creative. What you've got to do is take out the judgment out of this, put it aside, take the weight off it, and say, this is the way I am. And take the weighty words like paranoia and remove it and say vigilant.
Okay.
You know, and then just look at it that way and say, okay, this is the way I am. This is. Let's just start with that. That's the beginning of our experiment.
I have a quick question to ask.
Sure.
Take an issue like procrastination. People are hesitant to remove the judgment on issues of procrastination because they want to be more productive.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that people don't really change by beating themselves up.
Absolutely do
so
not.
So then what is the... So if you remove the judgment, the fear is, well, if I don't judge my procrastination, I'll just be that way forever, and nothing will change. Hear what I'm saying?
I do. You know, but procrastination is built on fear, right? It's the fear of making the wrong decision. It's kind of... Now, so if procrastination is based on fear, the obvious cure for procrastination that gets harmful is to get yourself to feel safe.
Right.
And getting yourself to feel safe is getting yourself to feel an inner feeling of safe. Now, have you heard the previous shows I've done on narcissism?
Not all of them.
Okay, they're great. And they were about trying to find this image self that we live, you know? Here's this image self, the person you're trying to be, and this image that you're trying to be, performing so that you'll get the love and approval, and where that all comes from. And that self is ambivalent. That self is ambivalent because it doesn't have a real self underneath it. You know, it doesn't feel that real self. And the rest of this show is going to be about finding that real self. Once you get that connection, and once you get on the task of finding the real self, the procrastination disappears because your decisions are easier.
Great. Thank
okay,
you.
We'll be talking more about it. So let's go back for a moment. I'm sorry to the rest of you callers. Let's take another step in learning who we are, okay? Here's another tool for you, blame. Blame is a way of protecting our narcissistic image. You see, we have this image of ourselves. We don't want to crack it. If we blame others for what we feel, then we never get to find out what we feel, you see? So if you say, people make me scared when they yell at me, see? You make them, the yellers, the source of your emotions. You say, they make me scared. They're not the source, you are. So if you make a minor change in this, and this is what I'm suggesting to you as this journey, the tools that I've learned, and say it as a sequence rather than a blame, you would say, I get scared when people yell at me. That's different than people who yell at me make me scared. You see, there's a two-part sequence there. You have a feeling when something happens. Then you start to learn about yourself, you see? You kind of identify, when this happens, I feel this. When this happens, I feel this. You see, other people may not get scared when people yell, but you do. So instead of blaming your mate for all your misery, try thinking about it as a sequence. Instead of saying, you make me angry, or he makes me angry when he comes home late, try saying to yourself, I get so angry when he comes home late. And then you might push it. You say, you know, I get so angry when I'm suddenly stuck being alone. Now, that's a big clue. Maybe I get angry when I'm stuck being alone is different than it's just because he's late. It's because he kind of left you alone for a moment, and you're stuck with yourself because you're waiting for him, and you can't get involved in the stuff you normally get involved in. So what really happens is you're not angry because he didn't come home. You're angry because you're alone. You may not seem like much, you know, of a difference when you report sequences. Instead of blaming, you start learning about yourself. In this example, I know a woman who used to get furious at her husband, who's usually unpredictable in his time of getting home. And when he was late, she got angry. And when he got home, she was angry. And a day later, she was still angry. And the next day, she was still angry at him. So instead, she said to herself, learning this lesson, I get angry when he comes home late. Instead of he makes me angry. And she reports, she tells me about how she felt the anger differently. She felt it very differently when she wasn't his fault. It was just as a result of, and she felt this anger, and she said she felt it in a different way than she ever did before. When he got home, she expressed it, but then it left. She wasn't angry any longer. She didn't have to hold on to it, because she faced herself during that time. So remember that saying, that old saying, when you point a finger at someone, you're pointing four fingers at yourself. And it's a kind of a nice saying, because each rise in emotion is an opportunity to learn about yourself. And when you find yourself blaming someone else, then you can say, oh, here's that opportunity to learn about myself. Here's one of those chances. What can I learn about me? So blame is a key learning tool. Now let's look at a third tool in this search for the true self. Make another list. And if you don't know who you are, one way to find out is to ask yourself, who am I not? Right? Now, that's a big list. Keep this list. Make it personal, like a journal. Enter things that you do every day that feel alien, like, I am not a nice person all the time. I am not a mother all the time. I am not a person who likes to get up at 7 a.m., and I'm not someone who likes the crowded subway. I am not a caretaker all the time. I am not ready for sex all the time. The rule here is that you make a list of who you are not. And it's very important for the first week, as you start making your list of who you are not, don't make any changes. It's very important because the mind will not let you see who you are not and who you are if you're going to rip away at the structures. So you have to be aware of impulses to change things. Any change that you eventually make, you can make over time. You can plan your change. So if you're not someone who wants to work from 12 to 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. every day, and you're tired of it, you say, this is not me. Make that on your list. Get to know it. Get to know it really well. Because eventually, you will start eliminating the things you're not. And what will be left, what will emerge, is who you are. And this is big, but a very worthwhile task. So these are some of the ways that you could find out about yourself. These are some of the ways that you could find out about yourself, and I'm hoping that you could kind of keep them as a review. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, concluding this series on narcissism. We'll be taking your calls a little later. This is some of the ideas that you could do with yourself, and this last one especially is the biggest one. Who are you, or what are you doing that's not you? Ask yourself every day, I'm not this. Do you ever eat fast food, and you find that you're eating a fast food, and it really tastes like junk, and you look at it? Or do you get home every night and make yourself a quick meal that's bought at a store, and you're eating it, and it tastes terrible, and you say, ooh, this is not me. This is not me. This is not me. The real you sneaks up every now and then, like when you're on vacation. You know, and then you suddenly relax and you feel this real you, you know? So it's trying to determine who you are not. That is very important in this path of self-discovery. These are some of the ways that might be helpful to you that I've learned in the past. And we're going to be talking about more when we come back from our break. We're going to take a break for a moment. We'll be back with you in just a short while. You know, friends, I made these recordings many years ago, and just listening to them and remastering them for you, they really touch my heart because of how accurate and how wonderful the collaboration worked between the callers and the information I had for you. This is what I consider to be the truth, you know. This is the basis of all that grandiosity and depression and the fight for being loved. So we're three-quarters of the way through it, and there's one more side yet, which brings a little more information to you. Thank you. Thank you for being with me during this time. You could either fast-forward this past the music, or here's a little musical gift for you. ¶¶
99 with Armand Jamil. WBAI 99.5 FM, listener supported.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille, back with The Positive Mind, continuing our exploration on narcissism and some of the ways to find your true self. We've talked about a few different things that you could do today. A little earlier, we talked about some of these roles, and if you haven't heard the first part of the show, feel free to call my office and get a copy of the tape, and you'll hear the first part. But we're talking about different ways that you can kind of get an idea of who you are rather than who you've been programmed to be. And these are some of the things that I found valuable. Now, here comes my biggest lesson. This is a big but very worthwhile task. Here's another big way to find out about yourself, and that is to make time to do nothing. Now, of course, if you're somebody who never does anything, you have to make time to do something. But most people need time to do nothing. You see, nothing is quite something. This is a conversation that is only for children. Nothing is quite something. Nothing is the space in which the true self gets a chance to appear when you're doing nothing, you see? One of the things that was poured into the mold of all the narcissistic selves is the compulsion to keep busy all the time. They knew that if you did nothing, you would begin to question who you were. So they inserted a program to always keep your mind busy. Even TV and radio's popularity emerged out of this need for distraction from the self. An idle mind is the devil's workshop. People are so used to doing something that they fill in the time with anything. That's what gossip is all about, getting involved in other people's problems. So you don't follow the program of the narcissistic non-self design, you know, so that you do follow it. They want you to follow this program of live up to the image and don't question anything. You know, it was the USA in 1970. That's what junk books are all about. You know, these books and these periodicals that have really nothing in them. You know, that's what they're all about. They're distractions. That's what the O.J. Simpson trial is about. It's about a distraction. There's actually a phone number now that you could call every day and spend 40 cents any time, day or night, to find out what the latest thing that happened in the O.J. Simpson trial is. Because you don't know what to do with your time. You get a spare moment. Let me call up and find out what is happening at the O.J. Simpson trial. That's what all advertising is about. Buy this perfume and we promise you, you will never have a moment of nothing. You will be besieged by men crawling all around you, keeping you busy, hoping that you never have to spend a moment alone. People get involved in the silliest things. My good friend Dieter was visiting America recently, and after a week I asked him what he saw here. He lives in a farm in Italy, and he's a very wise man who was once a very busy psychiatrist. He said, "It's amazing, Armand. Everybody makes a big deal out of everything. The headlines in the newspapers. There was even a headline about how much rain there is." He said, "Armand, it's only rain. Why is that the headline, how much rain there's going to be?" So why do we get so far away from our true selves? And that's when we get away from that, and when we get down to that glimmer of ourself, you know? Like when you're on vacation, when you slow down the distractions, when your real self emerges. A lot of people used to say to me, you know, "I hate being coming back from vacation because I hate coming back to reality." I realize it's on vacation is when you see reality. That's when the real self emerges. Everything else, all the distractions, all the busyness, that's where the false self is operating. So get off the track of the unnecessary train. Stop accumulating more than you need. Stop having babies and buying properties that need your constant maintenance and attention. Stop for a while. That's what I did back in 1987. Remember the story we started 4 weeks ago? I was at a conference recently in a hotel room, surfing the TV channels. Oh, I'm not sorry. It's not called surfing the TV. Yes, I was surfing the TV channels, trying to get a weather report for the plane that I was going to catch. When I passed by the Sandblaster Blastoff, which is on one of the TV stations, I couldn't help it. I had to watch. This was an organized beach contest in which teams compete in a series of beachy things, like climbing over walls, hurling monkey bars, crawling on the sand, canoeing to a raft, getting on a jet ski, and racing to a short course, going back to that raft, swimming to shore, swinging on ropes to crawl to the end, and then crawling on the sand and then jumping in a plastic pool on the beach. And they had teams doing this. The team from Hawaii was competing against the team from New York, and I was awestruck. I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, why is this on TV at 9 o'clock in the morning? What's this doing here? What was the meaning of this? Then they announced that the winning team, which had been the bottom competition after they had 30 teams, they were down to the Hawaii-New York team, would win an AM-FM radio. And I listened, and I said, there's something important going on here. I wondered what it would be like to get involved in it. So I tried to imagine that I was going to get really wrapped up in it. And I really had to push myself to think that what this was and that this is important to somebody. So I made it important to myself. And as they ran the course, I pumped up my adrenaline. Here I was sitting on the edge of a bed in a hotel room at 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning, actually watching the most meaningless event I had ever seen. Hundreds of people watching from the beach grandstand, and millions were watching on TV. I revved myself up as I saw the Hawaiian team beat the New York team by 3 seconds. And they interviewed the winners, the captain, in all his glory and his crowning achievement. And he said, well, I really felt fabulous. I feel fabulous having won this. We got down here last week and discovered that if you grab some sand before getting on the monkey bars, you get a better grip and move much, much faster. And we practiced all week. But the New York team wasn't around. We made sure that this wasn't when they were around because we didn't want them to know. And that's how we beat the New York team. We picked up 4 seconds on the monkey bar run by putting sand in our hands, and everybody was jubilant. At this point, one of my friends knocked on the door, and I opened the door, still revved up, and he asked, hey, Armand, how are you? And I said, I'm really upset. The New York Beach Sandblaster team just lost the world championship because the other team outsmarted them by grabbing a fistful of sand before they did the monkey bars. And my friend looked at me funny. He'd never seen me do this. Well, that's the way it is with folks. I wondered if people will actually tune in next week now that the world champion, Beach Blast-Off champions are there. Why would they tune in? But people get involved in funny things, and I guess this is one of the things they get involved in. I took a day off work yesterday on my birthday, and I did nothing. A lot of people called to wish me well, and when they asked me what I was doing, I told them nothing. Now, the people close to me said, that's great, enjoy your day. And the people who didn't know me so well offered to fill my time immediately. Doing nothing is my absolutely favorite activity. So consider some nothing time. There's a real self knocking on the inside of your chest waiting to meet you. So these are my big tips for getting to know the real you. But I must address Alice Miller's book and what she said, because that's what started this whole line of inquiry, The Drama of the Gifted Child. Alice Miller, who wrote the book, which I recommend strongly, says that the only true way to get to the real self is through therapy. Not any old therapy, she says. So for those of you who would consider psychotherapy, let's go over it. I've been a therapist for over 2 decades, a quarter of a century, almost half my lifetime. I've studied most forms of therapy and practiced my own eclectic synthesis of what's out there. I've taught, trained, and supervised many therapists, and that's mostly what I do nowadays, supervising and teaching. But of all the therapy I've always seen, the most effective is the one that Alice Miller talks about in The Drama of the Gifted Child. I call it reconnective psychotherapy. It's also called the intense feeling process, and sometimes it's even called primal therapy, but primal therapy got a bad rap from Arthur Janoff. Alice talks about her personal work with one primal therapist in Europe whose name was Stedbacher. Is Stedbacher. He wrote a book called Making Sense Out of Suffering. Now keep in mind that Alice Miller is a psychiatrist and was trained in traditional psychoanalysis. When she discovered Stedbacher, she saw a way to recover the lost self by traveling through all your repressed feelings, and that's what Alice says. Alice says that the real self is available right underneath the repressed feelings, the feelings that you weren't allowed to feel. So instead what you're doing is feeling this other level which keeps the false self going. And she's right. It does work. It certainly this kind of therapy accelerates the growth process. But Stedbacher himself is very new to this. You know, what he does is very good, but very limited in scope. So Dr. Miller was like someone who ate her first fresh carrot after eating canned fruit all her life, or canned vegetables all her life. She was amazed and now writes that everyone should eat only fresh carrots. There's more to vegetables than carrots. See, so Alice Miller had sampled only one thing and thinks that it's the only way to go. I think there's a lot of different ways to go. The process of therapy that Alice Miller talks about, and you could read about it in The Drama of the Gifted Child, is great. But there are other Stedbacher-style therapists doing the same and deeper work, and I know quite a few of them. You know, the criteria you could use as to whether a therapist is a decent therapist or not, or can take you through this intense things, here's the criteria. Do they have a soundproof office? If not, they always have to be wondering if their neighbors are going to complain if you cry, shout, or express yourself too loudly. The therapist becomes like the parents, telling you to control your emotions because they're worried about what other people will think, so it doesn't work that way. There are many intense feeling therapists around, and that's one way of accelerating your work, you know, of getting to find out a little bit about it. So that's it. That's what I've got for you primarily. Now, with all of this in mind, the tasks, the things that you are considering doing, I do want to hear from some of you. I'll respond to one note that I got from someone who writes the following. Dear Armand, thanks so much for the narcissism series. Very helpful as I cut off a 10-year relationship too. It wounded me too, but I also wanted to stop being the person who I was whenever with this ex-friend. But I couldn't find a way to break off without perceiving myself as a mean, self-centered person, not good enough to be loved. But I also know I'm lovable. Please discuss how to heal this wound. And don't forget, from JL. Well, you know, that's one of the issues. I mean, that's one of the things that happen when we invest in someone else, this validation of ourselves, when we make someone else, their love of us, be the thing that validates us. That's where we get in trouble. So when they leave, or when they die sometimes, or they break up with them sometimes, you're kind of left with this feeling non-feeling. In a way, you feel better because they're gone. In another way, you feel terrible because someone is saying, I don't want you around. Or even if you leave, they're actually saying, I didn't want to change to keep you around. I mean, the bottom line of it is, where are you in the middle of all this? It's not, you're not just there to be loved. That's not what life is about. Loving is wonderful. Being in love is wonderful. Having someone love you is wonderful. But it's not all about love. It's about self. It's about being the best kind of person you could be. It's about being whatever is real to you. We're going to take some of your calls to address some of this. Some of you on the line now. Let's talk to a few of you, and we've got a few minutes. Hi there. You're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
I have faith in experiencing oppressed feelings, but I have difficulty recognizing what feelings have been denied me.
Yeah, I understand. So you have experience in having gone into some of these feelings?
No, I have faith in the theory.
Faith in the theory. Each emotion was felt first in childhood. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
You know, when we're kids, we feel anger. When we're kids, we feel sad. When we're kids, we feel all kinds of things. Everything kind of happens when you're a kid. You feel it for the first time. Then you grow up. And as you grow up, each time you experience that emotion, one or another memory gets attached to it. Now, we've learned from a psychiatrist named Penfold back in the, I think, 60s, who did some research showing us that the mind remembers a lot of things that are connected to emotions. For example, they would take a little pin and they would stimulate a part of the cortex, and they would find that people could smell things that they only smelled in childhood, that there were sensory memories connected from all the way back in childhood that was stored somewhere in the brain.
Can those memories be...
Yes.
Must they be triggered?
Well, let me tell you, let me finish this and tell you how it works, okay? So then you take one emotion, and you take an emotion like a person comes in and they say they're feeling sad. and you have them feel that sadness fully. Now, a therapist, a good therapist, facilitates that. And I don't do therapy anymore. I just do these one-time consultations. But when I was doing therapy and watching the other therapists, the ones I train, they take a person and they help that person indulge that feeling, just the feeling. And as they indulge it deeper and deeper, and they feel safe in the environment, and they feel sadder and sadder, the memories start clicking into place. They remember when they felt sad a few years ago. And then they remember when they felt sad years before that. And then they remember they felt sad when their dog died. And then they remember a sadness even before that. And the memories click into place. And all the repressed sadness bursts into this one giant cathartic feeling. And all the memories are opened. And I've seen it happen over and over again. It's amazing.
Can they be triggered consciously, through conscious means rather than indirectly?
Well, I don't think this is indirectly. See, I think this is the most direct way.
I see.
You know, you have blocked memories from childhood, is that what you're saying?
Well, I would not, I'm unable to recognize whether they're blocked, because if they were blocked, I wouldn't recognize them.
I understand what you're saying. You know, to take an experience with it, and let me tell you the kind of therapist. There are a lot of therapists who do this work. There's people, I know Charlotte Saunders in New York, Ivy Frankel, Harriet Friedman, Scott Baum, James Ballin. These are all people who do this kind of intense feeling work. There are, I would say, three schools of therapy, four schools of therapy that really go there. No, not using hypnosis. One, I would say, is the kind of intense feeling primal-oriented therapy. Another one is bioenergetics. Another is Gestalt therapy. There's even one called rebirthing, but unfortunately, a lot of the rebirthers, many of them, are not educated in psychology. They just have this one process. Not saying that they're all that way. And I think you got to really know, have an education about the human mind when you take people into the recesses like this. So there are a number of different tools, and one of the things they use is they may use something like hyperventilation to kind of disorganize your mind to let the feelings emerge. You know, they do things like that. It's very dramatic, and it's not for the faint-hearted, but it certainly is a dynamic form of therapy. And if you want to find out about it, or if you want me to refer you to somebody in your neighborhood, I know the people in town. You feel free to call me at the office.
Okay.
Okay, and I'll tell you who does it.
Can I have your number?
757-4488 in New York. 212-757-4488. Okay, and that's for the rest of you. If you want a copy of today's show or this whole series on the drama of the gifted child, or that other show I mentioned called When to Trust Your Feelings, that's another good one. Call me at the office, 757-4488. Let me take another call. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hi. Armand?
Yes.
Hey, 12 years ago I was a patient at Dr. Freundlich.
Oh, yeah.
Talking to you before. All those things, Gestalt, primal, and rebirthing.
Are you on a speakerphone?
No.
Are you on a remote phone?
You want me to go to a different phone?
Yeah, because you're breaking up.
Yeah.
And breaking up is so hard to do. Breaking up is so hard to do. Man's talking about David Freundlich, one of the pioneers, a psychiatrist who was a pioneer in primal therapy, who years ago, was starting to do this work. Oops. Still there. Pick up the phone. Hi there.
Better?
Yes, much better.
Okay, great. Without going into the details, I currently have suffering from a terrible financial crisis as well as a health crisis, and I am on a speakerphone. Okay. One of the things I've noticed is that for all of the help, and he was tremendous in helping me.
David was great, wasn't he?
Yeah, fabulous. But of course, you know, your problems are lifelong. They don't end just when you become aware that you know, you have these problems. They continue to some degree or another. But given I'm on disability, so not working, so I have all this time, and I'm free of the normal treadmill type stresses that we're all suffering from. And I've been almost forced to. Think in the moment, that just about every moment, and what I've come across is that my biggest malady was this perfectionism, and how it made me impotent to the point where I would never actually actualize my full potential, and it's funny how when, maybe you can explain that, the phenomenon, but when you are relieved of the daily stresses of life and this treadmill of money and financial problems and it's all gone, that somehow, given, of course, the tremendous help that David gave me, that you're able to finally hit a big moment in your life that's been, for all of your intelligence, you actually missed and you just don't recognize it.
There's a question in there, and I think the question you're asking, you're saying, okay, so I did some personal research, I did some work on myself, and here I am, I'm without a job, I'm on disability, right, and I have a lot of free time. Is that true?
Yes.
Right? But it's not that you've chosen not to work. So you're still under the pressure of you know, making things work for yourself, don't you? You have money crisis all the time?
Well, my illness is very, very serious, so it's beyond the point of even planning for the future. So, and I am alone. And the funny thing is that I tried to revive relationships with my estranged brothers and sister. One of them worked, two of them were a disaster. And I think that, this probably goes beyond the scope of this show, but we're all alone, ultimately. We all have to learn how to love ourselves. And I've been very successful in how I've handled my illness.
That's what I'm hearing.
And as opposed to other people who need more support from their immediate family or their friends.
Well, you see, that's kind of what I'm hearing. You've come such a long way from before when you saw David finally to where you are now, and then you're in this tragedy of having a deep illness, you know, and where that's put you. And even from the sound of you, you know, the despair is not so heavy as it would be with so many people because you're still asking the question. But it is a little bigger than the scope of what we're doing here, because I would love to talk to you, and especially since you and I have David in common. Give me a call. Give me a call at my office. Let's talk, okay?
Yeah, just one more point. David's last moments, I was privileged to be a patient of his.
Yeah.
I saw the absence of an emotional crisis and how he continued his work and how he dealt with it. And it was real. I guess I'm using that as a guide and a model.
Yeah. I was there with him at his deathbed. It was kind of amazing. You know, I remember shouting at him, you know, David, tell me what happens after you leave. Get back to me with a message.
As if he knew.
As if he would know. Okay, give me a call. We'll talk. This is Armand DeMille, 212-7... Oh, let's take another call. We got plenty of callers. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. I was wondering, when you're doing nothing, what are you doing? Because I'm going away this weekend. I'm going to be alone with my wife in the country. I'm thinking of experiments along those lines.
Great.
What do you do when you do
great.
Nothing?
It's doing nothing.
You must be doing something.
No, you're doing nothing. I know what you mean. But let's take nothing and say that we're going to do nothing. And to do nothing, you quiet your mind in some way. You're just sitting there, you know? If you're in a forest somewhere, you're on a bench somewhere, you're in a room by yourself, just say, I'm going to do nothing. And you don't go to sleep. You just stay there. And if things kind of occupy your mind, you kind of let them swim in and swim out. And be in this place called nothingness. Now, nothing is a very big place. It's as big as the universe.
Scary place sometimes.
Well, that's it. The whole thing is to get off it being scary, because it's non-scary. There's nothing scary about it.
Or it's challenging you. You may have to change your whole life when you find out something.
Nah, that's the belief that keeps you going from, you know, from ever letting it happen. It's just a little leap. There's nothing scary in it, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of a wonderful place, but it's like a little door you got to open. It's like, you know, people aren't afraid of death. They're afraid of dying. It's got to creak this door open and get past it until you get to that point where you feel that kind of blankness. And in that place, you'll feel yourself filled with such a beauty, you know,
mm-hmm.
And you begin seeing who you are. It's quiet time. Quiet
is the next
time.
Step kind of up to you, or is there something else to take beyond there?
There,
you know, like
forget
what?
About next steps. You're in the step.
Yeah.
Take it on. Give me a call next week. I'd like to hear what happens.
Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Bye.
Well, this is Armand DeMille. That concludes our four tape series. I hope you found this as valuable as many others do.